For this Monday, the 31st of August, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us. Here are some of your headlines. In an often biting speech, Democratic nominee Joe Biden attacking the president. In a strongly worded address in Pittsburgh, marking a new chapter as both the Biden and the Trump campaigns add new events to their schedules. The story just ahead. Also today, the U.S. topping 6 million confirmed cases of COVID-19. That, according to data compiled by Johns Hopkins University. In fact, we've seen 1 million more coronavirus cases and about 21,000 more deaths in just the past 3 weeks. The total number of cases worldwide now stands at 25 million. That means the U.S. accounting for nearly a quarter of all the cases around the globe. Worldwide, we have 4% of the global population. At the White House, Chief of Staff Mark Meadows says the ball is now in Speaker Nancy Pelosi's court as he blames the Democrats for an impasse on any new coronavirus relief bill. The Trump administration is offering a $1.3 trillion package. Congressional Democrats say it does not do enough, especially for states and cities. Ahead, a preview of tomorrow's Democratic Senate primary in Massachusetts and some new developments in the Mideast peace agreement. The story shaping Washington today. It's all ahead on C-SPAN Radio. We begin with campaign 2020. Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden today blaming the president for escalating violence in America's cities. It follows a weekend of demonstrations, including one death in Portland, Oregon on Saturday. Biden's speech at times turning harsh and in direct his criticism aimed at the president, which took place inside of a steel mill in Pittsburgh. The former vice president placing the blame for civil unrest in the country squarely on the president's desk, saying he, the president, has inflamed tensions, not calmed the nation, since the police killing of George Floyd on Memorial Day weekend. We carried it live here on C-SPAN Radio. Here's a portion.
The road back begins now in this campaign. You know me. You know my heart. You know my story, my family story. Ask yourself, do I look like a radical socialist with a soft spot for rioters? Really? I want a safe America, safe from COVID, safe from crime and looting, safe from racially motivated violence, safe from bad cops. Let me be crystal clear. Safe from 4 more years of Donald Trump. I look at this violence and I see lives and communities and the dreams of small businesses being destroyed and the opportunity for real progress on the issues of race and police reform and justice being put to the test. Donald Trump looks at this violence and he sees a political lifeline. Having failed to protect this nation from the virus that has killed more than 180,000 Americans so far, Trump posts an all-caps tweet screaming law and order to save his campaign. One of his closest political advisors in the White House doesn't even bother to speak in code. She just comes out and she says it. Quote, the more chaos, violence, the better it is for Trump's reelection. Just think about that. This is a sitting president of the United States of America. He's supposed to be protecting this country, but instead he's rooting for chaos and violence. The simple truth is Donald Trump failed to protect America. So now he's trying to scare America. Since Donald Trump and Mike Pence can't run on their record that has seen more American deaths to a virus, this virus, than the nation suffered in every war since Korea combined. Since they can't run on their economy that has seen more people lose their jobs than any time since the Great Depression. Since they can't run on the simple proposition of sending our children safely back to school. Since they have no agenda or vision for a second term, Trump and Pence are running on this, and I find it fascinating. Quote, you won't be safe in Joe Biden's America. And what's their proof? The violence we're seeing in Donald Trump's America. These are not images of some imagined Joe Biden America in the future. These are images of Donald Trump's America today. He keeps telling you, if only he was president, it wouldn't happen. If he was president, he keeps telling us that he was president, you'd feel safe. Well, he is president, whether he knows it or not. And it is happening. It's getting worse. And you know why? Because Donald Trump adds fuel to every fire.
The speech airing primetime on C-SPAN. It's also available on our website at cspan.org. The headline from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, Joe Biden says President Trump foments fear and violence. And to give you a sense of just how pivotal Pennsylvania will be in this campaign, the Trump campaign announcing today that he will be visiting La Trobe on Thursday. The president's scheduled to speak at Arnold Palmer Regional Airport at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. We, of course, will carry it live here on C-SPAN Radio and on C-SPAN Television. Well, tomorrow the president is scheduled to be in Kenosha, Wisconsin, defying pleas from local leaders to stay away for the time being. On Twitter, the president writing the following, quote, "If I did not insist on having the National Guard activate and go into Kenosha, Wisconsin, there would be no Kenosha right now. Also, there would have been great death and injury. I want to thank law enforcement and the National Guard. I will see you on Tuesday." Well, the Wisconsin governor, Democrat Tony Evers, and the city's mayor, also a Democrat, asking the White House to reconsider tomorrow's visit. So far, there are no plans for the president to meet with Jacob Blake. The arrest began when a white police officer shot the 29-year-old in the back 7 times. He remains hospitalized tonight. And at today's White House briefing, Jeff Mason of Reuters News with this line of questioning to Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany.
Broadly, what does the president want to achieve by going to Kenosha tomorrow? And what is his or the White House's response to local and state leaders encouraging him not to come at this time?
So, two things. First, the president wants to visit hurting Americans. He shows up just like he showed up this weekend in Louisiana and Texas in response to Hurricane Laura. So, he wants to show up in the city that's hurting. And also, I think it's just important to note that our federal response, look, in Kenosha and Minneapolis, there was violence on the streets. And literally, within 24 hours, you saw a turnaround when federal officials came in. So, I think highlighting that the federal government has done a lot in the way of using law and order to create peace, but showing up for hurting Americans is the primary concern.
Just to follow up on that, like he didn't show up in Portland, where there were also protests that he talked about a lot. Is it not also because Wisconsin is such an important political state?
The president's showing up to see hurting Americans. He goes to several states each and every week, and this is another one in a long line of many.
From today's White House briefing, and joining us on the phone is Alex Swoyer. She is covering politics for The Washington Times. And clearly, we saw today from the Biden campaign, the rhetoric is heating up as campaign 2020 really moves to another level. So my question to you is, what can we expect as we see the demonstrations in Portland, Oregon, Kenosha, Wisconsin, and here in Washington, D.C.?
Yeah, I expect this to be something that both campaigns are going to be talking about for several days, if not weeks ahead, until there is some sort of result in Portland, which we have not seen yet. So I think there's been a dramatic shift within the Biden campaign in terms of addressing the violence and the riots, because, you know, they had the convention for almost a full week and it really wasn't a topic whatsoever. So I think that that's something that the former vice president really wanted to hit on today. And I think he did. He did well. He mentioned comparing that, you know, the warning about what would a Biden's America look like, and trying to remind voters that this is a Trump America. Right. Like, this is happening under President Trump's watch. However, you know, I think that the president, his campaign spokespeople have been out and pointing out, first of all, that, you know, it's been a while since we've seen Joe Biden on the campaign trail. He was out today, but he didn't take any questions. So that was something of note. And then also, they want to remind everyone that the violence is happening in Democrat-led cities where they've offered to send help. And when they do send help from the feds, it seems to stop the looting, rioting, and arson. But, you know, it's mayors like Ted Wheeler and the governor of Oregon who have rejected that help so far. And that's where you're seeing the major unrest.
And with regard to the mayor of Portland, Oregon, your colleague Stephen Dining pointed out that he is facing pressure not only from the president and Republicans, but also from left-wing groups that say it's time for the mayor to step down. So this really is encircling the city of Portland, Oregon, in a way that we haven't seen before.
Yeah, and, you know, in a way, if you're watching this over the weeks, I mean, it's been 94-plus days, right, of protesting different and rioting to different degrees in Portland. You have to kind of somewhat feel a little bit for the mayor there, because it seems like he can't really catch a break. He's either getting it from the right or he's getting it from the left. And I kind of thought it was interesting, his press conference yesterday, because he kind of really took a tone of going after the president, saying that this is the divisiveness and his rhetoric is what has led to all this violence. But, you know, before, and I think it does help the president to remind everyone that, you know, Ted Wheeler was out there. He joined the Black Lives Matter protesters. And then as I think he actually got like mocked or called out. I remember they turned on him and he kind of said, you know, no, he was listening. He wanted to make changes to his own police department and the funding there. So, you know, he even though he's joined in on the protests and the movement, he hasn't necessarily been accepted. So there's really not really a line that we can see, obviously, of one group or one side welcoming him. And so he's kind of been left out there, and he wasn't able, to be honest, to address how he's going to fix this in the future, because that was one of the questions he was asked yesterday. Well, what's your plan? And he really didn't give one.
We're talking with Alex Swyer of The Washington Times, and clearly with coronavirus and the economy dominating the election early on, since the death of George Floyd and more recently with the incident in Kenosha, Wisconsin, this really is adding another layer to this campaign.
Yeah, you're right. You know, I think that as political reporters, we're trained to watch what the campaigns are really talking about and what they're focusing on and if there's a sudden shift. And that's been obvious with the Biden campaign. They've really been going after Trump and his handling of the coronavirus, because that seemed to be, you know, either economy or COVID was the top issues on voters' minds, according to the polls. But more recently, it seems like voters have, according to pollsters, been focusing on the violence and the unrest. And that's been an issue they're concerned about. And I think it's evident when you talk to some different campaign experts, when they're talking about the suburban vote, the suburban woman, too. They were responsible for delivering the House to the Democrats in 2018. And I think that there's some concern from Democrats that, well, if they're worried, if this rhetoric from the Trump campaign about warning that this violence could come, you know, spill out of the cities and come to you in your home, that could court some of those voters to Trump come November.
More details at WashingtonTimes.com. Alex Swyer here in Washington. We thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
For this Monday, the 31st of August, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. Here are some of your other headlines. The GAO is reporting that nearly 70% of the $1.6 billion in coronavirus stimulus payments sent to dead people has been recovered. It was a $2.2 trillion coronavirus relief package enacted back in March that provided for one-time direct payments to most Americans of up to $1,200 per adult and $500 per child. As we said at the top of the program, the U.S. has now surpassed 6 million cases of coronavirus. Nationwide, the death toll has topped 184,000. NBC News is reporting that FDA Commissioner Stephen Hahn said that he would be willing to fast-track approval for a potential vaccine before critical Phase 3 trials are completed, but he said he would not rush the process to please the president. And this from American Airlines and Delta, following the lead by United Airlines in permanently dropping those change fees for travelers flying within the U.S. It comes as this pandemic continues to hit the airline industry particularly hard. And now to Massachusetts politics in tomorrow's bitter Democratic primary. It is a battle between two famous names in Massachusetts, Senator Ed Markey, seeking another term, and Congressman Joseph Kennedy III, the son of a former congressman, the grandson of Robert F. Kennedy. It is a campaign that has turned deeply personal in recent weeks. We'll get some background from a Boston Globe reporter. But first, Yentl Menino, she is the widow of Boston's former longtime mayor, on her support for Congressman Joe Kennedy.
Tommy always said government is about helping people, and to truly lead, you have to be present in the community all the time, hearing what people are talking about and having personal conversations. Joe's does that. He knows that for government to help people, it has to listen to people and show up for those he represents.
Anybody that knows Menino in Boston and that knows what retail politics is about, it's Menino. They proved that literally over decades of service to the city. It's the same type of service I've tried to show over the course of my campaigns and over the course of my time as member of Congress, and the way we try to run this race. And I'm honored to have that support.
I'm Angela Menino, and I'm proud to endorse Joe Kennedy for U.S. Senate.
That from the wife of former longtime mayor of Boston, Tom Menino. Senator Elizabeth Warren is a former Harvard professor, and one of her students was Joe Kennedy. But in this race, she is supporting her Senate colleague, Ed Markey.
We need Ed Markey in the Senate now more than ever. And here's why. He's a leader, he's a fighter, and he is a true progressive.
No one tells me where to stand.
Ed is leading the movement for the Green New Deal. He has spent his career as our country's greatest champion for clean energy jobs and as big oil's worst nightmare. It's his legislation that would make the strong gun laws in Massachusetts a model for the entire country. He's giving hope to those suffering from the opioid crisis by expanding treatment centers and recovery services. And he's fighting to protect for pre-existing conditions, lower drug costs, and to make universal health care a reality.
We're going to have to fight.
On the big issues facing Massachusetts, from economic justice to net neutrality to a woman's right to choose, he is on the front lines. We need Ed Markey in the Senate to keep our country and our Commonwealth moving forward. Ed is my friend and my partner in the Senate. I've got his back, and I know that he will always have yours.
With more on the Massachusetts Senate primary tomorrow, we're joined on the phone this evening with Victoria McRain. She covers politics for the Boston Globe. And I wonder if you can go back to the moment in which Congressman Joe Kennedy announced that he was going to challenge Senator Ed Markey last year and how this race has unfolded.
Well, what's hard to remember now, but even before Joe Kennedy's name had been rumored to even be a possibility to get into this race, Ed Markey was seen as incredibly vulnerable here in Massachusetts. You had just had this earth-shaking primary challenge from Ayanna Pressley against a longtime incumbent, and she was successful in that. And then suddenly people started to look at, well, Ed Markey was remarkably unknown despite his long tenure in Democratic politics in Massachusetts and serving 6 years in the Senate by voters in Massachusetts. He was very ill-defined or not very well known by the general electorate. So there was lots of talk here in Massachusetts about who might challenge him. And then, lo and behold, Joe Kennedy is the one that does it with the most famous name in Massachusetts and all of Democratic politics, arguably. And yes, from the moment he got in, even before he got in, there were polls showing this double-digit lead over Ed Markey. But since then, things have, steadily changed and shifted in Markey's favor. And it's been a kind of gradual process. But on the one hand, Markey's campaign really seized the moment and did everything they could to define their candidate the way to fill in that blank space in the voter mind with this image of Markey as this progressive champion who has long been on the forefront of key arguments. Policy fights, particularly the environment, net neutrality, signing on to Medicare for All. And in the meanwhile, the Kennedy campaign never did a very good job articulating to voters sort of the positive reason why he felt it was important to challenge this longtime incumbent.
Because it really has divided Massachusetts Democrats with these two leading figures in state politics. Let me ask you about early voting in the state and what that tells you about the results tomorrow.
Well, so we've had our Secretary of State said just this morning that more than 800,000 Massachusetts residents had already voted in the primary election. The vast majority of that, more than 600,000, were mail-in ballots. And on the one hand, you could say that this is all very good news for Ed Markey because most of the people that are voting by mail are wealthy, white, suburban voters, stalwart Democratic voters who make up Ed Markey's base. But on the other hand, everybody, always adds the caveat that we are really in unprecedented territory here for a Massachusetts primary because of the COVID-19 pandemic. The voting options have expanded dramatically. We've never before had a week-long early voting period for a primary, and we've never had this sort of no-fault ability to just mail in your ballots. So
on the one hand, it all, you know, with the polling and kind of the demographics of who is voting, the conventional wisdom is that this is all very good news for Ed Markey. But there's also the caveat that no one really knows what this dramatically expanded voting opportunity will mean for turnout and who is actually turning out.
And one final point, because you cover the news, you don't write the editorial, but the Boston Globe editorial supporting Ed Markey really became a flashpoint for the Markey campaign and also for the Kennedy campaign, criticizing the readers of the Boston Globe. What was your take on that?
My take on that is, one, the Kennedy campaign did not intend to make its criticism public. It was in an email to supporters, kind of, you know, I read it as sort of rally, you know, bucking up the troops in the face of the, you know, what was a blow. I do think the Globe editorial helped Markey in this, you know, defining himself. It had became the centerpiece of a ad campaign that a pro Markey super PAC ran on TV. On the other hand, I am not sure how much editorials sway voter opinion anymore. You know, Ed Markey had already been well on his way to establishing himself as quote unquote the progressive with policy chops in the race compared to Kennedy before the Globe endorsement, but it certainly didn't hurt him.
Victoria McRain, she is joining us from Boston. Her work available at bostonglobe.com. Thank you for being with us.
So glad to be here.
At the closing bell, the Dow losing 223 points. The S&P was off by 7. The Nasdaq, though, jumped nearly 80 points. And on this last day of August, U.S. stocks posting their biggest one-month gain since April. Also in money news, plans to quickly complete a deal between the Chinese parent company of TikTok and a potential American buyer thrown off track. The Wall Street Journal is reporting that a number of interested parties huddled over the weekend to weigh new Chinese restrictions that appear designed to affect a potential sale. The Journal saying that China may be trying to slow down a purchase by companies like Microsoft and Oracle. The Jerusalem Post is reporting this evening that Israel and the United Arab Emirates have started discussions to open embassies in each other's countries. Those talks came during high-level government meetings today in Abu Dhabi. The U.S. delegation in those discussions, including the National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien and White House Special Advisor Jared Kushner, who of course is the president's son-in-law. Here's what he told reporters earlier.
I want to thank and congratulate the Crown Prince, His Highness Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed, my friend, on his leadership and courage. Last year, he celebrated the Year of Tolerance and welcomed Pope Francis to the Gulf. And this year, he welcomes Israel. Mohammed bin Zayed is truly leading the new Middle East. Also historic was the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia granting permission for this Israeli commercial flight to use its airspace. This is the first time that this has ever happened. I would like to thank the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia for making that possible. On the plane, we asked the pilots to fly faster because there is great urgency between the people of both countries to break down old barriers, to get to know each other, to form new and hopefully very deep friendships. While this peace was forged by its leaders, it is overwhelmingly desired by the people. The very few who have been critical of this peace agreement are the ones with a long track record of failure and trapping their own people in misery and poverty. They exploit division to maintain power, but their rhetoric has grown tired and the region is breaking free from their grip. The Middle East is filled with brilliant, industrious, tolerant, and innovative people, and the future belongs to them. I ask everyone today to join us in celebrating this peace and to help us expand it throughout the region and the entire world. Thank you very much.
And that from the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, earlier today in the United Arab Emirates. He made reference to that first ever direct flight by an Israeli plane from Israel to UAE. That plane, which did have an Israeli flag, was also the first ever Israeli flight over Saudi Arabia. Here's more from today's delegation and the president's national security advisor, Robert O'Brien.
When I was here last year, it was to thank the Crown Prince for the UAE's assistance in recovering an American hostage from Yemen, Danny Birch. I can tell you the Crown Prince, Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed, is a friend who can be counted upon. It is especially remarkable that we have flown here directly from Israel, Ben Gurion Airport, on the first ever commercial flight to Abu Dhabi. This flight was made possible by the UAE's recent historic agreement with Israel, the Abraham Accords, which normalized relations between America's most reliable and most capable partners in the region. These two great nations are beginning the process of exchanging ambassadors and are cooperating in a broad range of fields, including finance, education, healthcare, trade, and security. This will unleash economic growth in both countries. The combination of Israeli know-how and high-tech and the UAE's capital and financial centers is going to create something very, very special in the Middle East. On the religious and cultural front, Muslims who wish to pray at the Al-Aqsa Mosque will now be able to fly from Abu Dhabi directly to Tel Aviv, and they will be welcomed. We are truly impressed by the leadership exhibited by the UAE and by the Crown Prince in this effort to make peace. Without his vision and without his courage, the Abraham Accords would not be possible. This agreement represents the most significant step toward peace in the Middle East in over 25 years. At long last, nations are putting aside old ideas and old grievances and embracing a better future, a future of shared interest and shared goals. Working together, the UAE and Israel will be more secure than ever. Together, they'll form a united front with the United States against Iran. We believe that additional Arab and Muslim countries will soon follow the United Arab Emirates lead and normalize relations with Israel. This trend will put the region on a truly transformative path of stability, of security, and of opportunity.
Those comments by Robert O'Brien, the President's National Security Advisor, and the peace agreement involving the United Arab Emirates and Israel. By the way, the UAE's population is about 9.8 million residents. Here in Washington, Democrats on the House Oversight Committee threatening to issue subpoenas if officials from the Pentagon and State Department do not testify at a hearing next month on the administration's strategy in Afghanistan. In a letter to the Defense Secretary Mark Esper and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, the Democratic lawmakers saying that they are requesting for, quote, the final time that witnesses from both departments testify on September 9th at a hearing before the Oversight Committee's National Security Subpanel. If that happens, of course, we'll cover it on the C-SPAN networks. Comedian and host of Last Week Tonight, John Oliver, promising during his program last night to give $55,000 to local charities if a Connecticut city follows through on its joking threat to name its sewage treatment plant after him. The mayor of Danbury, Connecticut, announcing on Facebook that the city planned to rename its sewage plant the, quote, John Oliver Memorial Sewer Plant, after the comedian criticized the town on his show. Well, John Oliver said he was surprised but delighted at the idea. He also was critical of the city for not following through after the mayor said the video was, quote, only made in jest. Here are his comments last night on his HBO program.
Finally tonight, a quick update regarding Danbury, Connecticut, also known as the Hat City, which is appropriate because much like the bowler hat, Danbury is a superfluous accessory with no practical purpose that went out of style in the 1930s. Now, you might have noticed that I've taken a few cheap shots like that at the city of Danbury over the last couple of weeks, and perhaps, unsurprisingly, the people there have taken notice. But that boy wasn't actually Danbury's only defender. There was also this official response from the Danbury Hattricks, their local pro hockey team.
John makes several valid points. Our railway museum is quite charming, and we do wear our Hat City moniker proudly. He did his research like any intrepid reporter should, which he is. That is, when he's not taking breaks to film such cinematic classics as The Smurfs, Wonder Park, or my personal favorite, and this is true, his iconic role as Dick Pants in The Love Guru. There is one area, though, where John did not do his homework, and that is, of course, the idea that he could give anyone in Danbury a thrashing.
Again, very good. Honestly, Danbury might want to seriously consider changing its nickname from The Hat City to The Young People Who Seem More Than Capable of Taking Over My Job City. Although I'm really not sure why they would actually want it. Yes, we both live in sad, empty voids where hope goes to die, but at least Danbury has a railway museum. We haven't had one of those since season 4. So let's get down to some brass tacks here, because I've got a very serious proposition. I will donate $55,000 to charities in your area. $25,000 to this food bank, another $25,000 to fill all the requests as of this taping from Danbury school teachers on Donors Choose, and $5,000 to ALS Connecticut, apparently a cause close to the host of that Danbury Hattricks video. And I will happily do all of that if, and only if, your mayor makes good on his promise to officially name that sewage plant after me, because I want this. I need this. And if your mayor is thinking, well, hold on, that sign was just a Photoshop, I'm not going to spend public money to make a real one, don't worry, that has been taken care of for you. So, to you, Mr. Mayor, I say this. You have exactly 1 week to respond to this offer. And please, I beg of you, don't Danbury this one up. Your move, Danbury. Your move. I want to hear from you. I want my sewage plant!
That from John Oliver on his HBO Sunday Night program last week tonight. We'll keep you posted. Finally, it was 85 years ago when Congress passed the Neutrality Act. It imposed a general embargo on trading and war materials with countries that the U.S. may have been in conflict with, coming as the storm clouds were growing in Europe just before World War II. The act also declaring that American citizens traveling on any warring ships did so at their own risk. President Franklin D. Roosevelt, August 31st, 1935.
I had hoped against hope that some miracle would prevent a devastating war in Europe and bring to an end the invasion of Poland by Germany. For 4 long years, a succession of actual wars and constant crises have shaken the entire world and have threatened in each case to bring on the gigantic conflict which is today, unhappily, a fact. It is right to point out that the unfortunate events of these recent years have been based on the use of force or on the threat of force. And it seems to me clear, even at the outbreak of this great war, that the influence of America should be consistent in seeking for humanity a final peace.
That's from 85 years ago, President Franklin D. Roosevelt. A reminder, this program, Washington Today, it's easy to get wherever you get your podcasts or go to our website at cspan.org/podcasts. For this final day of August, Monday, August 31st, I'm Steve Scully in Washington. We thank you for listening.